You know, even Bitcoin itself did not appear out of thin air. There were many prior attempts that failed. And even when Bitcoin, when it came out, it actually had a lot of flaws. And Satoshi and other early developers had to fix a number of those flaws. So my main point here is that...
Bing bong, we are live with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend in the house at the Bitcoin conference, Jameson Law. Jameson, welcome to the program. But first, obviously, we just heard the breaking news here where Trump is planning to potentially keep a strategic reserve of Bitcoin, and for his first step is not selling. So I want to hear your initial thoughts and initial reactions behind the whole thing.
Yeah, it sounds like some of Saylor's ideas might have rubbed off on him. But you know, my main takeaway is something that I just posted the other day, is that, look, Bitcoin doesn't need any help from politicians. All we need is them to get out of the way. And they just keep getting in the way, blocking us, and they're actually being anti-innovation. So you know, it's great if they want to do constructive stuff as well, but stay out of the way and we'll be happy.
Yeah, and it seems like that was kind of Trump's message throughout the whole thing, where he was like pointing about, you know, Operation Choke Point 2.0, he's going to finish that and, you know, kind of abolish some of these things. Now, there's been a big attack on privacy in that aspect. Do you think that that's going to still continue, or do you think that the U.S. is still kind of doing a full like 180 on the whole Bitcoin policy in general, just kind of seeing the buzz around all this and the conference and everything like that?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't really hear any touching on privacy issues so much. And really, privacy is not top of mind for many people. So I would have been surprised if privacy came up. The trend is not great for privacy as well. I mean, and there were some recent regulations that just went into effect this year that actually strip a lot of privacy protections away, some of which I use myself, using legal structures, for example, to protect privacy and ownership of publicly registered assets. So, there's some court cases that are still held up around that, but it's generally not looking good. And I don't have any reason to believe that the government is going to give up on its desire for more surveillance.
Yeah, because it seems like to me that the U.S. government never really hated Bitcoin too much. It's just they wanted to know what you're doing with it, basically. They want to track it and they want to tax it. And so that's why we've seen a lot of these Lightning wallets and everything like that essentially leave the U.S. Now, do you kind of agree with me on that point, or do you still think that the government, you know, previously maybe hated Bitcoin and now they're almost doing somewhat of a turn on it because they're seeing how much it can potentially swing an election?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's the whole Bank Secrecy Act, AML, KYC regime, regulators wanting to have as much information as possible so that they can exert as much control as possible. And so it's a tricky thing whenever you're asking for a political figure to promise to give up power. It's just not in their incentives to do so.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this whole thing is very interesting, right? I mean, first, like, we're getting businesses start to take Bitcoin on their balance sheet, more institutional level adoption. Then we're seeing more of, you know, potentially countries, right? We had El Salvador come on, and now we're potentially talking about the U.S., depending on who gets in office and kind of that whole situation. But I want to hear about your thoughts potentially on RFK as well, because he came in here last year. He kind of seemed to read a book almost last year, but this year he seemed very well spoken and he did a lot of education in the past year. Now, I'm hopeful Trump could do the same thing if he gets elected, and that's kind of the way things go, but we shall see. So were you impressed with kind of the year-to-year change from RFK and how he was, talking about Bitcoin and potential policies and things like that?
Yeah, look, I mean, the short version is RFK has been doing his homework. Trump just started doing his homework maybe a month or two ago. So RFK is way ahead of the game, and he's able to construct much more salient talking points and much more, I think, thoughtful policy, simply because he's had so much more time to do so. It is unfortunate, of course, that he's in a position that it's, you know, incredibly unlikely that he's going to end up as president, but hopefully he does land somewhere where he has a fair amount of influence and he can take those ideas and put some pressure on the right people to get them enacted.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. So, like, as a business owner in the U.S., right, where you're kind of regulating around the Bitcoin and the crypto industry and everything like that, how much weight do you put on a lot of these regulations going on? Like, do you guys keep a very close eye? Yeah, how are you kind of tracking that as things are developing here? Because it is ever changing, it seems.
Yeah. So at Casa, our primary goal is to not be regulated as a financial service. And this is tricky to do because we're operating in a fairly gray area of the market. We're primarily operating off of some sort of unwritten rules around like what constitutes custody and what constitutes becoming a financial service provider. So we would much prefer to have clarified rules that say, like, as long as you only do these things and don't do these things, then you're safe. But as it is, this means that, we have to maintain pretty active relationships with various political organizations that, have their ear to the ground, because frankly, we don't have time to be listening to what all the bureaucrats in DC are saying to each other. This stuff is constantly moving, and it's always like, we might do this drastic thing, we might do that drastic thing. And so we don't have the insight to understand all of the connections and relationships to understand if one thing that comes out of one politician's or regulator's mouth is something we should even be worried about. Like, what is the likelihood that this thing will actually go from just becoming an idea to becoming law? So we do have to spend time, though, joining meetings and reading newsletters and basically getting the synopsis from the people who make it their full-time job to be in the know.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that that's a very important aspect of, just what's going on in this ever-changing landscape. I mean, Trump was even coming out and saying, and he doesn't want to take away any of the Bitcoin or crypto jobs from the U.S. He wants to keep them all here. Now, it seems like that, I don't know. I mean, do you, I guess, trust him in that sense where that can happen? Or, is just the climate in the U.S., just making it more and more difficult to build a business around you because there's just not clarity, the inflationary aspect, all these different kind of factors that are just making it a little bit harder to build a business in the U.S.
Yeah, so as a general rule, I don't trust any politician further than I can throw them. But, I do know Trump is a businessman and he understands business. And, I do believe that he wants the best for America, with regard to our economy, our business infrastructure. And so you note that a lot of the things that he said, he was talking about the industry. So he's focused on the economic and business aspects of this stuff. And, I think that he is surrounding himself with the right people, which is why he's started to get some of the right talking points out there. Now, what does it really mean? All it really means is we need to have regulations from actual written down concepts and not the current regime, which is regulation by enforcement. So like that's why people are fleeing overseas, is because there's no clarity. We only get clarity basically when you get sued or prosecuted by one of these agencies. And so when you're living in fear like that, you're constantly making this decision of, should I even stick around here or should I go somewhere where I can focus on my business and not be worried about, political change of the winds or, which bureaucrat is currently sitting in office at some given agency and, are they going to have some sort of vendetta against me and what I'm trying to do?
Yeah, no, definitely. That makes a lot of sense. But, it kind of just, affects overall scaling of business and all that kind of aspect as well. But, obviously we've had a lot of things happen this year in the Bitcoin industry. A lot of things have changed, not only like the presidential candidates that we're going over here. We've had traditional finance kind of come in. Now, the U.S. seems to be looking at Bitcoin more as like an investment, and that's kind of the way that things are trending, whether it's digital gold, however you want to describe it. Now, I know that you've talked at length about like kind of the scaling issues with Bitcoin. Now, do you foresee, I guess, a way to potentially move the, and shift the narrative to more of the peer-to-peer transactions here in the U.S.? Or do you think because of the dollar dominance and kind of the state that we're in, that, you know, as long as we have the dollar and it doesn't completely crash and inflate away, that the digital gold narrative will kind of be here to stay for a while?
Yeah, I mean, Max Keiser actually said something earlier today where he was basically talking about how you know, I think Bitcoin is a mirror. And you know, one way to rephrase that is, you know, you see Bitcoin as you are, not as Bitcoin is. So different people can look at Bitcoin and see different things. And so if we're talking about the United States, we have a really good financial infrastructure here. Pretty much everybody is able to make payments if they have the money to do so. We don't have a ton of disenfranchised people compared to most other countries. And so for that reason, like Bitcoin as payment technology has just not been very interesting to people. There are some censorship issues if you're trying to do gray or black market stuff. And so, you know, that's why Silk Road was, you know, one of the big booms that really kicked off this whole industry. But by and large, you know, Bitcoin as an investment asset, as an inflation hedge, as a just completely new asset class is much more interesting to the average American than any of the myriad of interesting like payment technology functionality that could happen. And, you know, I'm a technologist, so I'm certainly interested in Bitcoin being far more than just digital gold, but we have a lot of work to do, and that's what I'm going to be focused on.
Yeah, so is that, I guess, I mean, I think that that gradual progression here in the U.S. as the dollar kind of, you know, essentially kind of fades away, right? I mean, I kind of see two paths that Bitcoin, we could get to a hyper-Bitcoinized world. There's either one where the dollar crashes and burns and then we got to rebuild from the ground up, or there's one where maybe we have, you know, the strategic reserve of Bitcoin and, you know, the dollar slowly fades away because, you know, governments will still be human and print too much on top of it. And, you know, the government essentially has a spending problem. So we'll have this slow transition, which will give developers more time in order to, you know, combat some of these problems. Now, say the scenario first happens where everything crashes and burns. Now, how realistic would it be to get to a hyper Bitcoinized world in the next decade or so with development of everything and the issues that we have? I mean, the Lightning Network's great in small transactions, but it still has some issues and, you know, running a Lightning node and everything like that. So do you think that it is realistic to get to a point in maybe the next decade or so where we could see a hyper Bitcoinized world?
Yeah, I mean, 10 years is a sufficiently long enough period of time, though, you know, base Bitcoin protocol development is going very, very slowly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is one of the things that I'm being more outspoken about, because we have a lot of great proposals out there, and I would love to see a number of them get implemented. But, you know, there's the sort of social dynamics and general issues of network protocols ossifying, like it's almost a physics problem with network protocols and becoming harder and harder to change them over time. So if anything, you know, this is why I think we need to really put our foot on the gas and try to get as many improvements into Bitcoin earlier rather than later, because it's only going to get harder to do so. So, you know, I think there is a path there. Will it happen? That's really going to be incumbent on all of us who are participating in it to say, you know, we need to keep pushing forward, because I certainly would not want for there to be a major economic catastrophe anytime in the next few years, because you know, Bitcoin would not be able to handle it, at least in the way that we would want. The only way that it would really work would be everybody starts trading Bitcoin IOUs from Coinbase or something.
Yeah. So, I mean, I want to expand on that. So what are like some of the developments that you think that need to be pushed forward? And, you know, does it worry you at all that, you know, potentially we can get some, you know, developments pushed in too quickly? Or is there like, you know, the vetting process, like how are you kind of viewing the quickness comparative to like the battle testing, I guess, of some of these new implementations?
Look, I think the process itself is extremely conservative. And I mean, I wouldn't push to make it much more accelerated than it is. But I am worried that it is continually decelerating. And it's not so much that developers aren't working as hard. Like I said, we already have a lot of great proposals out there, but the problem that we're running into is that developers are more than happy to spend a lot of time thinking very deeply about and constructing improvements to the protocol and even battle testing them sort of ideologically or on test networks. But almost nobody these days wants to take up the mantle and actually champion a proposal through the gauntlet of the activation process. So that's kind of where we are right now. And we're going to continue talking about the proposals and doing what we can, I think, to convince the rest of the world that a given proposal has merit. Now, if we want to be more specific, the proposals that I think are most crucial for us to get to a hyper Bitcoinized world are those that enable more innovation and more development of second layer solutions. And so if you think about it, there has been this kind of explosion in L2s lately. But a lot of them, I think, can rightfully be argued are not true L2s in the sense that if you define a Bitcoin second layer as something where you should be able to move your money from Bitcoin to the other thing back and forth trustlessly, like Matt Corallo told us is basically the most important aspect of Bitcoin, then from that perspective, you could argue that the only true L2 that we have right now is Lightning. And I think it's important to note, because I've seen this trend of a lot of people saying, we only need Lightning, or look, we created Lightning, we can create other L2s. Lightning would not have been possible if we didn't make multiple changes to Bitcoin's consensus code and the rules and activated multiple pieces of functionality at the base layer. And so my point here is that we have the opportunity to do this again. We have the opportunity to activate more functionality at the base layer that will then lead to an explosion of development in L2s, because we will then have the ability for people to create these permissionless side chains and second layers.
Yeah, so I guess there's always the narrative of that Lightning is, it's difficult to scale. And it's going to take some time. And I know you kind of went into, some of the changes that needed to be made, or some changes needed to be made in order to develop Lightning. Now, Lightning seems to be like an imperfect solution for global payments. So would you think that there would need to be maybe like a secondary kind of L2 created? Or is there a world where the Lightning network can scale and essentially become, what we use on a day-to-day basis throughout the world?
Right, so I don't think you're ever going to see a perfect silver bullet solution just magically appear out of thin air. Even Bitcoin itself did not appear out of thin air. There were many prior attempts that failed. And even when Bitcoin, when it came out, it actually had a lot of flaws. And Satoshi and other early developers had to fix a number of those flaws. So my main point here is that technological progress is an iterative thing. It's very rare that you just all of a sudden have like an amazing order of magnitude improvement. And so this is true for Lightning as well. Like, Lightning is not done. It has been around in production for about 5 years, maybe 6 years now. And even over that period of time, it has become easier to use and more reliable. But it is not infinitely scalable. There are proposals that would make it more scalable, even possibly orders of magnitude more scalable, but once again, would require more changes to Bitcoin's base protocol. So this is why I think it's just important that we understand Bitcoin has the ability to evolve, and we shouldn't throw that out the window because we're afraid that we might break it.
Yeah, and it seems like there's two sides of the coin, right? Because obviously, as you lined it out, it's almost like, just general physics, where more people are going to be resistant to that change. Mm-hmm. And I guess, like, how would to the average Bitcoin user, the average Bitcoin Core person, or the average person who runs a Bitcoin Core node, and you know everybody can essentially participate in that network. How are we going to get that message to you know the general population in order to say, hey, you know, this could be a good potential change, but you know there are potential negatives that come from these changes as well. Like, I mean, say what you want about like the ordinals aspect of it. That's been very controversial, and that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for some changes that I believe it's like BIP 312, if I'm correct. But you know, all of these changes have had some sort of, you know, some controversy around it. So it's made more people resistant to it. So I guess how do we say, like, you know, we need these changes in order to help develop and help hyper Bitcoinization. There might be some trade-offs in the initial beginning, but you know, as Bitcoin is, you know, those trade-offs, maybe the scams things, those, you know, ordinals eventually will potentially die out, like things like that. And you know, maybe it's fun and clogging up the network in the short term, but in the long term it would be better. Does that make sense?
Are you looking for the best way to store your seed phrase? Well, I've got it for you. It's Stampseed. They've got the number one punch place where you can order a full-on package where they've got every single thing. They've got all the letters. You could just get it in there. And they've got this sick hammer, which they've engineered to make it so easy for you to punch in that titanium steel plate and store your seed phrase in the most secure way possible. So go ahead and get your Bitcoin off of these exchanges and use promo code GREENCANDLE for 15% off. They're helping power the show. They've got the Bitcoin logo. You can punch it into your seed phrase as well if you could see it here. They've got a lot of cool stuff. And now I'm helping empower you to get your Bitcoin off an exchange utilizing Stampseed and storing your seed phrase in the most secure way possible. Now get to it. All right, back to the show.
Yeah, well, you know, Bitcoin from a governance perspective is crypto anarchy. You don't vote with your node. What you do is you signal to the rest of the network, like, I will accept these types of transactions. So the short version is that it is incumbent upon the node operators, if they wish to be running a node as part of the governance process of Bitcoin, they just need to pay attention. Whether that's, you know, reading the mailing list or just reading release notes when a new version comes out. Because it is important if you're running a node that you're keeping it up to date, because there's, you know, critical security patches that tend to go out as well. And if you don't update your software for a long time, you can actually be putting yourself in a position of vulnerability. You know, Bitcoin is the sum of all of us who are participating. So, you know, if all you're going to do is download the software and run it, you know, that still gives you empowerment by, you know, allowing you to audit what's going on with the ledger. But if you want to take that next step and you want to be more active in the governance process, then you have to pay attention, you have to spend more time, and you have to actually talk to other people to, you know, express your feelings.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, I mean, you need to have a deeper understanding, right, in order to do that and essentially, you know, vote, right? I mean, it's like what we would do with a democratic election, right? If everything was, you know, kind of even and fair at a certain point, you know, everybody has the same amount of vote. You need to be educated in order to realize what you're voting towards and kind of moving towards. So on the second scenario that I lined out a little bit earlier with the slow kind of development into a hyper Bitcoinized world, right? Because we kind of just went over the full crash and burn type of scenario. In the slower version, how do you see us essentially like kind of getting to a hyper Bitcoinized world if, you know, we have the strategic reserve of Bitcoin in the United States and kind of have the dollar? Do you see us as like potentially keeping the dominance of the dollar for an extended period of time? You know, we always see that famous meme where the U.S. empire is falling. Mm. Would that potentially bring us back up? How do you see that kind of playing out, or as a potential to, I guess, yeah, help the U.S. dominance?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it is dependent basically on how the rest of the world acts. And I guess you could say how, like, the enemies of America act, right? And so There does seem to be some movement to try to kill off the petrodollar. If that continues, that can certainly be problematic. If some of the nations that are acting very favorable towards us because we offer them various like military protections, if they change alliances, then all bets are off. So this really becomes a game of geopolitics, right? So it's very difficult to speculate on. Geopolitics is not my forte by any means, but there are a number of ways that the dollar could end up being substantially weakened.
Yeah, and it seems like that's kind of the general trend in that direction. Now, I know you said you were somewhat worried in the first scenario where there needs to be faster movement with the development in order to make Bitcoin more of a global payment system and make it efficient for everybody involved. Now, in the longer scenario, that could potentially play out by giving developers more time and just overall more robustness to the network. Now, in a hyper Bitcoinized world, do you see any potential flaws in that outside of just the scalability and kind of like the transaction speed and the block aspects of it with anything in order to scale? I'm kind of getting that point. That's right.
Well, I mean, there's also privacy issues. Bitcoin has terrible privacy. Lightning's a lot better. eCash, which is newer, has great privacy, but it comes with other trade-offs. But stepping back even further, I think one of the issues that I worry about is actually related to the governance, but even from the developer perspective, is who is contributing? And so if 90% of Bitcoin development and contributors are all in America, who the hell cares about making these, highly scalable, highly private payment systems if Americans only see it as digital gold, right? So point being, I am somewhat optimistic about this because we are seeing more developers come in, but we need to get people from all different backgrounds. Diversity is strength. We need to get perspectives from people who are in a number of different situations because Bitcoin is supposed to be the best money for everyone. Mm-hmm. And if it's going to be the best money for everyone, then we need to get the input from everyone to say, what do you need? What is the perfect money that can cater to all of these myriad of life situations and threat models that people are dealing with. There's a lot of people who live in much more oppressive autocratic regimes, and they need privacy a lot more than we do, just from a normal day-to-day living perspective.
Yeah, I never really thought of the privacy aspect kind of affecting it down that rabbit hole as well. So, I mean, that is a really interesting point, but it seems like there is a lot of development going on, at least starting, right? They're having Bitcoin conferences in Africa. Mm-hmm. I've met a few kind of people from there. There's obviously a bunch in Europe as well, and Asia, obviously North America. It's kind of growing, outwards. But, something that I kind of, is almost resonating with me from what we heard earlier was that Trump wants to bring all the mining, all the development, mm-hmm. all the jobs back to America.
Sure.
So right now, majority of the hash rate is already in the U.S. comparatively to every other country. And like you said, a lot of the development is in the U.S. So is that centralization of, I guess, the industries around Bitcoin something that almost scares you a bit?
Yeah, I mean, centralization from almost any metric is not optimal. Now, I would say I'm still optimistic long term about hash rate centralization, and Matt Corallo talked about this a little earlier, where he said, actually hash rate is somewhat decentralized, but the main reason why I'm optimistic about that is because it's a physics problem. Energy is decentralized, and the incentives behind mining push people to go and find that stranded energy, and it's all over the world. The bigger aspect of centralization with mining that we're worried about right now is really the pools themselves and like who controls the creation of block templates. And that's why Matt was talking about how Bitmain has kind of nefariously gone around and gobbled up a lot of the mining pools in the industry and not told us about it. And like the only way we find out about it is from a few very intrepid developers who are monitoring this stuff. And that's why it's preferable, once again, that we make upgrades to how we're doing this so that we can further distribute and decentralize that particular power, which could be abused.
Yeah, and that, I've heard that the Bitcoin mining aspect of it is not necessarily as like FOSS as the rest of the development. And is that an area as well that you think that needs to be pushed where there's more free and open source aspects in the Bitcoin mining pools and kind of that area as well?
Are you looking for the best way to orange pill your friends and family? Well, I've got a way for you that's got a little bit of a nostalgia factor. I've got Bitcoin trading cards. They've got the Genesis pack. I've got an open pack right here sitting here where you can hand out a bunch of these cards with some great, great artwork. We've got Tyranny. We've got Fear, Uncertainty, and Doubt right here, the FUD card. So we've got a lot of great things to teach you a bunch of lessons about Bitcoin in the current space. And they've even got some cool things of cool people even doing some stuff in the Bitcoin space. I've got the Bitcoin racing card here, even signed by my boy, Chris Primetime McKenzie. So you can get all of that at btc-tc.com. Use promo code GreenCandle. You can get 10% off your entire order to orange pill your friends and family and collect some cool artwork of people that are doing some awesome stuff in the Bitcoin space and help spread that orange pill around the globe. All right, enough from me, back to the show.
Yeah, I've talked to some miners to try to understand, and this is mostly because mining is by far the most cutthroat aspect of this industry. It's highly capital driven, highly capital intensive. And so, The miners tend not to care quite as much about some of the ideology as the developers. And so like I've spoken to some of the largest miners in North America and I've said, why can't you have one developer who helps you manage your own mining pool, And they're like, well, we just can't justify it because right now the mining pools that we use are basically free. So, why would we spend a couple $100,000 on a developer and then setting up infrastructure and all this other stuff? And because for the miners, it's all about the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, the way I view the mining industry is pretty, I guess, different in a sense of where, a Bitcoin company you like to see, or a company you like to see maybe putting a strategic reserve of their treasury into Bitcoin, where I think, because Bitcoin mining is all about the bottom line, it's better to distance yourself a little bit away from the volatility of that asset, right? If an oil miner essentially would hold oil or a gold miner would hold gold, it is kind of an odd thing. You don't really see that in any other industry except for in Bitcoin. So, it is weird where it's kind of like, yeah, they care about the bottom line, but you also see that they essentially like tweet it out to get the clicks, get the likes, get everything up, maybe get the stock price shooting up and things like that. Obviously, it's all speculation.
Oh, yeah. Well, the public miners are even a weirder business with some of the stuff that goes on there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think like just viewing it from like a publicly traded aspect of, how businesses are run. Obviously, Casa is a private business right now, but there's a lot more Bitcoin companies that are going public or holding, Bitcoin on their balance sheet of public companies. We just had Fold announce as well. So, from that perspective, with SEC regulation, do you think that is more, I guess, friendly, the more Bitcoin companies that become publicly traded because, in a sense, they want to be working with the SEC? Or is that almost a negative in a sense where, now we have all this information of whoever is utilizing these products. Now we got to worry more about privacy, worry more about, just kind of like the opposite of the Bitcoin ethos and getting the government starting to meddle into the Bitcoin space?
I don't know. I think it would probably be more likely to become a problem if we saw a lot of these publicly traded entities screw up and bankrupt themselves and a lot of people lose a lot of money. And there certainly has been some of that. You know, some of these miners basically got highly leveraged. And I don't know that any necessarily went out of business, but I think some of them kind of got like fire sold.
Yeah, no, that's fair to say. So yeah, I want to get into more about like the multi-sig and kind of the aspect of the self-custody and holding your own keys in that aspect, because, you know, as Bitcoin starts to develop, you know, there's already what they're say there's maybe 4 million coins already lost. So the 21 million cap is essentially, you know, now what is that, 17?
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that scalability of more people kind of holding that self-custody, almost quote unquote, making a self-donation to the network can hurt Bitcoin in the long term? Or do you think that that would just be a positive?
Oh, it's the old deflation monster question, right? And I don't think anyone who's in the Bitcoin industry is going to subscribe to Keynesian theory.
Yeah.
Deflation, I don't really have a problem with it. And it's mainly because at the end of the day, you have basic necessities. You know, you have to feed, clothe, and shelter yourself. And sure, I think a deflationary environment would disincentivize frivolous purchases, but that's probably for the best. Of course, it depends on what you're looking for. We have now, you know, quite a lengthy history of having this very consumer-driven society where it's a buy. And so, you know, from a macro level, would the economy slow down a bit if we were no longer doing that? Yeah, sure, probably. But I think the theory is also that over the long term, it would smooth out a lot of this like volatility of the business, you know, boom and bust cycles.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's fair to say. But if you kind of look at like the Bitcoin cycles now, like the 4-year cycle almost lines up a lot with like the business cycle. So, you know, with the halving and everything like that, people try to equate that with essentially, you know, helping that boom and bust cycle, if that makes sense. I, for one, don't really see it that way anymore, because there's like what, 8% of the coins left to be mined at this point. So I don't really see 8% driving that, you know, the price action and kind of the volatility. I see it more as the Bitcoin hodlers and maybe those donations to the network where, you know, people are either losing their keys or just at this point refuse to sell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you subscribe to that theory as well? Or do you think like the halving is still going to be more increasingly important as far as like, you know, I guess the price volatility goes?
I mean, I think halving is a narrative, and you know, maybe the narrative does have enough of a psychological impact that's what's causing the cycle to happen. But it's mystified me as well. It's like every time the halving comes around, I'm like, surely history won't repeat itself again, right? Because you generally expect that when a market repeats itself multiple times, then people should start trading against it, and you know, the pattern should disappear. But so far that hasn't happened, and maybe it is because it's more of the effect that the business cycle of the mainstream world is still having upon Bitcoin. And maybe if Bitcoin gets big enough, then that will finally stop happening. I mean, it does seem like the volatility is trending downward with each cycle, at least from a relative perspective. So, you know, will we eventually reach an equilibrium? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, so the volatility aspect is something that I've, you know, kind of like pondered on a lot here recently because of just the new implementation of these ETFs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, we've got BlackRock and all these other big money managers coming in and buying up a ton of Bitcoin just in dollar figures. And so now with that and the potential of like the US government buying Bitcoin and you know, at least holding it there, it seems like there would be a lot bigger players where that volatility could spike up again. Now, for the average Bitcoin pleb, just holding a few, you know, sats or a couple million sats, like kind of getting into the game. Do you see that as, you know, I mean, I guess essentially a positive because of just the, of that digital scarcity aspect where you don't necessarily need, you know, a full coin or whatnot? Or do you think that this, the amount of money and capital being flowed into Bitcoin and the attention around it is maybe a little early on because Bitcoin's only a 15-year-old asset at this point?
Well, I think there's a natural distribution system. Basically, as long as people are using Bitcoin as a savings and not as like a major you know, trading vehicle for most of their net worth, then, you know, I think if people just are consistently, you know, cost averaging in, then they should be fine and not have to worry about the volatility. Sure, it goes up, it goes down. But as long as you're doing that over a long enough period of time, you know, you get to the point where the absolute, you know, like dollar figure of your portfolio may swing wildly up and down, but from a relative perspective, over the many years, like I said, it does dampen. And then on the flip side of that, you know, as Bitcoin grows and becomes worth multiple trillions of dollars, then as I referred to the sort of natural distribution, the OG whales who just have an insane amount of it, they kind of provide a buffer or backstop there where they kind of put foot on the brakes once it goes too crazy, and they, you know, will offload their coins to, and that will of course result in dampening the volatility.
Yeah, that's interesting because it's all kind of, I guess it's almost like a human behavior question at that point. Like, how would a human react when, you know, their bags are getting pumped and, you know, and vice versa on the way down? Because, you know, generally speaking, we've seen, you know, people sort of FOMO in when it goes up and then sell off when it's going down.
Yeah, well, so that's what the newbies do. And then the OGs are doing the exact opposite, right? And so you have these two counterbalancing forces. And so the OGs are, you know, I think over time you get better at selling the top and buying the bottom, and as that happens, the volatility compresses because you have more people who are like, oh, it's way, you know, way too hot right now. I'll put the foot on the brake, and then vice versa. You know, when there's blood in the streets, I'm gonna scoop up those cheap coins.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, once you're longer into Bitcoin, you know, you kind of are used to the volatility, riding the waves up and down, that aspect of it as well. But you know, we kind of got it touched on it briefly about like the multi-sig aspect and kind of people losing their keys. Mm-hmm. Now, how important do you think that is going to be going forward, even though, you know, we have the ETF products, but I think as more people start to research into Bitcoin, maybe that's their first touch point. They buy the ETF and then they want the actual physical, you know, Bitcoin holding it themselves. How important do you think like the multi-sig is going to be just for the development of self-custody to give people more comfortability because they've never really had to do anything like this previously? You know, maybe you had the money underneath the mattress sort of thing, but, mm-hmm. you know, actually having that personal responsibility is foreign to a lot of people at this point.
Are you looking for the easiest way to get your Bitcoin off an exchange? Well, I've got it for you. It's Foundation Devices. They've got the number one hardware wallet in the Passport. They've even got a concierge service that can help you get your Bitcoin off an exchange within 1 hour private onboarding session. And they've got a great app too, which will give you extremely, extremely, extremely private features on that app. So you can use Bitcoin in the most secure way possible. So I've been working hard trying to get sponsors to help you get your Bitcoin off an exchange. And I found it with Foundation. And you can store your seed phrase with a stamp seed punch plate as well. So pair all those together. Use promo code GreenCandle at foundation.xyz and you'll get $10 off your entire order. All right, that's enough for me. Back to the show.
Well, this is what I've been focused on for nearly a decade.
Yeah.
And I think that really what I'm fighting against is human nature. So it's a very tough fight because human nature is to prefer convenience at the expense of almost all else. And so that's why the ETFs are so popular. That's why Coinbase has millions and millions of Bitcoin in custody. It's because people are not confident that they can take on the responsibility that is required to do self-custody. And so that's why my mission for the past decade has been to make self-custody more robust and more convenient. And one of the ways that we do that is by eliminating single points of failure. And there are many different strategies to do that, but the big one, of course, is to make it so that you don't just have one key that if you screw up, if it gets lost, stolen, whatever, then it's a catastrophe. So, this is what we're doing at Casa. We're bundling both the best-in-class hardware. We're building best-in-class software with a very simple user interface and offering best-in-class human support. And that's one of the things like a lot of wallets and self-custody solutions don't have, is they don't have the ability for you to actually get on a call with an expert and walk through a lot of the decisions that have to be made, a lot of personal decisions, and B, help you if you run into any weird technical error with any of the hardware or software, because it is still a lot of the hardware that's out there is still, built by nerds for nerds.
Yeah, and I mean, that's definitely, fair to say. I think that is developing and it's getting into a way. But you said something interesting there where, human nature is basically, to give a bunch of trade-offs for convenience. Now, do you see, the best way in order to develop and make more widespread Bitcoin usage as to develop products that are very similar to, almost like utilizing Bitcoin where you don't even know you're using Bitcoin to send it back and forth, right? Strike's like a great example with sending remittances, or like maybe potentially getting Bitcoin like as an Apple Pay or like Tap to Pay, those kind of products. Do you think that would be necessary to develop and kind of continue the widespread adoption of Bitcoin? Or do you think like everybody's just gonna have to like learn a new skill in a sense on how to maybe transact in Bitcoin and move it that way?
I think it's certainly possible to abstract away a lot of these complexities under the hood, and I'm optimistic that, especially if we get some of these protocol changes that I'm hoping for, that if we have this sort of proliferation of second layers and solutions that are tied to Bitcoin somehow, that we're going to have all types of assets and payments and crazy functionality that people can do. And under the hood, a lot of it may be like transported over Lightning Network, for example. The question then just becomes, how are the keys managed, and how is the software running these various protocols? Now, the cool thing is we're also seeing advancements in secure hardware, at least in the sense that over the past few years, it's basically become a standard for any halfway decent smartphone to have a secure element. And there's some new standards actually that are coming out that are being leveraged. They're leveraging that hardware. So there's actually a new, somewhat new standard called passkeys, which is being pushed forward by both Google and Apple. And it's starting to get rolled out across a lot of websites. Now, passkey technology, it uses private keys. And if you're using it on your phone, those private keys are getting secured in your key ring on your phone by your secure element, the hardware that's in your phone. And most of this passkey technology right now is being used for two-factor authentication. So, you have your username, password, and then you'll have actually the private key and the passkey that is used to prove that you are who you say you are, just as a different factor. Now, this is related actually to the product announcement that Casa just had this week, where we have started implementing passkey technology, but we've been doing it to actually secure your Bitcoin private keys. And the major thing that we announced this week was that we figured out a way to do that with YubiKeys, which are an extremely common, simple like USB device that there's like 20 million of them that are already in use, has 10 years of history behind it. And now it's possible for you to actually use this passkey technology as an envelope to wrap a Bitcoin private key that you can secure it in the YubiKey. You can also secure it on your phone using the secure element there. So long story short, you know, we're continuing to make progress on all of these things, and security continues to make progress. And so if you think about it now, as this passkey technology is getting rolled out, almost overnight, we're going to see tens, if not hundreds of millions of people who are suddenly using private key technology secured by dedicated hardware in their phones to authenticate with a variety of different services. And I think, you know, that's only the beginning.
Yeah, and it seems like then, you know, technology companies are starting to get into more of the privacy aspect because of, you know, potential to get frauds. I mean, there's always, obviously the Bitcoiners know, like the Google password manager is also, is not necessarily a safe place to hold, you know, anything, your private keys, holding your private keys on a Google Drive, right? Essentially, you get your Gmail password taken, everything can get taken at a certain point. So I think, like, it sounds like technology companies are starting to realize that. So are you noticing more of a trend in that as well, where it's, whether it's, you know, Apple with the iPhone and Google and whatever, these smartphones kind of, I guess, moving towards privacy as well? Because, you know, we saw Apple with the App Store too, kind of take away the tracking aspect of other apps, or at least giving you that option to not allow that. So do you see that as like a growing trend just in the technology sector as well?
Yeah, Apple's actually done a lot, especially with adding more protections to your cloud drive on iCloud. And so they do a great job of, you know, doing a lot of crazy technical stuff behind the hood and then slapping a really simple user interface on top of it. And so I think it's just a great example of why I'm optimistic that while these are very challenging problems, that they can be solved and they can be presented to users so that the user doesn't actually have to know what's going on under the hood. But this is the entire arc of technological innovation throughout civilization. Nobody other than really computer scientists actually understands what's happening if they like go on X or Facebook or load their email. Most people, they just see the screen as it's presented to them, and it's a fairly intuitive thing. And it's basically a requirement that, you know, as a part of user interface design, that you just make it intuitive, because nobody reads the manual, right? You can write all the documentation you want. Only the like 2% of nerds are ever going to read the documentation. So if it's not just blindingly obvious how something should be interacted with, then it's not going to get adopted. And so, you know, Apple, Google, a lot of the big, huge tech giants, they have figured out, you know, how do we do all this crazy complex stuff behind the scenes and then present a just extremely simplified interface. And that's also what we attempt to do at Casa.
Yeah, I mean, hey, I think that's the attempt, and, you know, kind of what everybody in the technology sector is trying to do, right? Solve very difficult problems, but make it easy to use on the user. Now, you've been in the Bitcoin Bitcoin space a very long time, building a company for a decade, coming in even before that as well. So, you know, what is one thing that you think that has surprised you of how far we've come here, sitting here in 2024, 15 years in?
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised that heads of nation states are already talking about it, and mainly at like the geopolitical level. And Max and Stacy also talked about this earlier today. I was somewhat surprised when El Salvador was the first country to, you know, say Bitcoin is legal tender and we're going to start accumulating Bitcoin, because I expected it would be a micronation that did that first. And so compared to a lot of smaller nations, El Salvador is actually reasonably large. But now, I think it blew all of our minds that the United States would be the next one after that. I expected, you know, Bukele going to be going around like Latin America talking to his peers and say, hey, you guys need to get in on this. But if the U.S. actually gets in on it first, that's just like another giant step forward. And if the U.S. starts doing it, you know, like all the other big countries are going to start talking to each other.
Yeah, 100%. Well, Jameson, you've been very generous with your time, and I appreciate you coming down and joining me here after this long day of the conference. Is there anything that you want to do to shout out CASA? Where can more people find out about CASA and what you guys are doing there?
Yeah, it's CASA.io, CASA.io, and you can always check out my Bitcoin resources site at bitcoin.page.
There we go. Awesome stuff. And Jameson, thanks so much, man.
You bet.
Thank you for tuning into the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.